It's Saturday, August 3rd, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, Santa Cruz. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on the program, we'll be taking your calls in the last third of the show, I should say. The phone number is 800-655-5877. I'll give out that information again and slower when I invite your participation in about 45 minutes. Okay. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the studio with me today is Ben Jaffe, and Ben is a web instructor and world traveler. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. And I hear you'll actually be traveling to the East Coast this coming month and a half, and you won't be with us.
Yeah, I will be. I actually wasn't going to be here today, but I happened to be passing through Sunnyvale, and here I am.
And you grabbed 30 news stories that were interesting to you, and we're ready to go.
We have so much news to cover today.
I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm a programmer, photographer, radio host, father, and all that jazz as well. You can learn more about what we talk about on GeekSpeak by going to geekspeak.org. Like, all about GPS spoofing, Ben.
Oh, yeah. All right. So, that's what we're starting off with today. So GPS spoofing, the way GPS actually works, it's what your cell phone uses to figure out where you are on the planet, or at least it's one of the methods. It's the most accurate one. And it's also used by the military to figure out where all of their things are. The way it works is it connects up with several satellites, and satellites just kind of orbiting around the Earth. The satellites know exactly where they are in space. And so what it can do is it can compare the time it takes for a signal to get to each of the satellites and back. And it by figuring out the distance and the amount of time it takes, they can figure out how far away it is from all these three different satellites or more and triangulate its exact position. And that's how we know where we are when we're navigating on our phones or anything like that.
And it used to be, when GPS was first started, that the government would actually modify the signal slightly to make it not accurate enough. And you had to have some additional information about the satellites to fix back. And then terrestrially, people would go, well, I know where this radio station is, and therefore I know if I collect GPS data from these three satellites and I get the wrong information by 15 feet, the 15 feet is shifted this direction, this area. And so there's radio digital signal system, RDS, gave corrective information to it. So basically, as long as you've got a point of reference, it's easy to then make it globally successful. I think now it's pinpoint accuracy.
Yeah, it's pretty, I think it's within a couple feet or something like that.
And this all relies on extremely good clocks.
Wasn't the idea that the military would have better GPS than the consumers, than the general public? So anyway, it turns out that GPS signals can be spoofed. So you can carry around even something the size of a suitcase, and you'll actually have a range up to around a kilometer, right? So what you can actually do is you can take your GPS spoofer, which are illegal to buy in the United States and illegal to use. Yeah. Apparently in the UK, you can actually buy them legally, but you can't operate them. Uh-huh. It's one of those strange legal things. But if you turn it on, you can actually, make things that are near you think that they're somewhere other than what they are. And actually, one group of students at the University of Texas in Austin built and successfully used a GPS spoofing device to redirect an $80 million yacht onto a different route. Now, they actually decided to do this, and they checked with the yacht's owners first. They didn't do this to mess with them. But basically, the idea is they made the yacht's automatic navigational system think that the yacht was drifting left, and then the yacht compensated. And it turned to starboard, and then starboard, and
of course, if you have an autopilot, that's how it's determined where it is.
Yeah, exactly. That's the only way airplanes and yachts and all kinds of things know where they are, is by GPS. And so there are actually a couple other issues with this. So
I'm thinking airplanes. I mean, yacht shifting, no big deal, but airplane shifting.
Well, actually, North Korea is using GPS spoofers that are mounted on these turret things, and so they can actually aim them. Like they were apparently testing these GPS spoofers on South Korea. So they were just pointing these GPS spoofers at South Korea and disabling the navigational systems or messing up to the point of no return. I guess I think it said
this is bad because I mean if you did this in a city environment where there's lots of people using GPS, all of a sudden the annoying voice would come on and say, take immediate U-turn at next stop.
When safe.
Yes. Make it,
or turn into this lake. Well, and of course, GPS systems aren't going to take you off of navigable roads. But like, for example, one of North Korea's attacks on South Korea, GPS attacks, affected over 1,000 aircraft and over 250 ships.
That's a really stressful time to be an airplane pilot.
In an airplane.
Let's see, all my life I've had GPS as a pilot. Oh, I don't have that anymore.
Well, okay. I guess not.
So, I mean, and it's not that complicated a process, I'm assuming. I'm assuming that there's no, the private key publicly, if that kind of security encryption doesn't exist. Basically, it's
not really.
I'm this satellite and I'm doing this.
It's a very old technology.
Anybody can say
so,
that.
Yeah,
that's not good.
Also, did you know that every day for somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes near the London Stock Exchange, someone blocks GPS signals, and the current theory is that it's a truck driver who is trying to block or mess up its employer's attempts to track where the truck is.
Oh, interesting.
But in doing that, whenever they drive by, they just disrupt the GPS signals all around.
Huh, interesting.
And it's really difficult to track down where these signals are coming from.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a pirate radio station. You can't really... It's very difficult to figure out where it's coming from.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the easiest way to do it with a pirate radio station is to look for giant antennas coming out of the back of their house, right?
But... Right.
Not with
it's interesting, you know, as we've gotten better and better at digital signal processing, it's easier and easier to make just general purpose radios that can do any frequency, right? So we have this ability now in our lives to have these really complicated RF systems that can do any frequency, which is really cool. Like in your phone right now, what you have is this complicated radio that can do all these different signal processes, a few of them actually, different antenna lengths. It's really the limiting factor. And those same digital signal processing can also do FM broadcasting, right? You could do that with the phone if you had the software necessary to do it. That's kind of cool.
Could you,
it wouldn't be very efficient. The length with the antenna would make it less efficient, but it doesn't mean it can't radiate a different frequency.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't be optimal.
That's kind of cool.
So I've got an interesting story about a programmer, Diego Monica, in
San
Francisco.
Speaking of hacking, right?
Yeah. I mean, not really hacking. Basically,
kind of.
You know, new restaurants show up, and if you're kind of a foodie, and unfortunately I'm starting to become kind of a foodie in my travels, you kind of want to go to a nice restaurant, right? So as a nice restaurant emerges, especially when it has limited seating, it's really hard to book a table. So the restaurant will have a reservation system on a website, some kind of form you fill out to reserve a spot.
So you don't have to call and occupy
one
of their staff.
And then all these online services that actually will allow you, like OpenTable, allow you to reserve a restaurant. You know, you can go to OpenTable and you can see all the different restaurants that might have reservations. You can book one.
Oh, it actually right through
is,
the service.
Yeah, it is actually either potentially calling the restaurant, probably not, or submitting a reservation request in the system. So what he found, he wanted to go to this restaurant in San Francisco, and he couldn't get a reservation because when the restaurant opened up 2 months out, 60 days, right, when it actually happened, he could never find a table. So what he did is he wrote a little bot, a little software application that ran every 30 seconds and looked at the website and see if there's anything open. And after it ran for a little while, he realized that at 4 a.m. every morning, some tables come online for 6 weeks, 6 months or 2 months out. And at 4:01 a.m., they're all gone. So what he discovered basically is that there's bots that are taking the reservations instantaneously, right? Scalping kind of these reservations most likely, right? And so he just was like, well, I can probably make my bot a little faster. So he made his bot a little faster. And now his bot can actually get reservations and also cancellations. Cancellations can happen anytime. Someone cancels and someone processes that, there could be a table open up at some point. So then he wrote this package, and it's open source, and I'll link to it from geekspeak.org. It's up on GitHub. But you can actually put in kind of you can run this bot if you're a programmer and know how to run Ruby code on a server. You can change this bot to say, well, I want Sundays afternoon, and point it to this restaurant or a few restaurants, and it will pick up a reservation for you.
So this completely completely defeats the online reservation thing, unless you're a programmer in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, you know, I've been kind of griping for a year or two about how the population in general should learn how to program. And one of the reasons I've been saying this is that in my little rant, at one time, the movers and shakers, the people that controlled the world, were the printing presses, right? Prior to that, it was people that could write books. So the illuminated script manuscript monks could write books, and books defined law, and the church actually owned the writers, and therefore they owned law. And then as you move forward into the printing press era, anybody that had a printing press and could make books or newspapers controlled the conversation. So the power became the people that have these other technologies. And the power right now is the programmers, right? We have the ability to modify our world at a level that other people don't, that don't have programming capability. So I want the populace to be able to program, just like I want the populace to be able to read. So this is a perfect example of it. You, not that it's crucial to be able to get a restaurant, you know, get a fancy restaurant reservation, but the point that it took a programmer to figure out how to do this is an interesting concept, that he's able to do something in the world that normal people that don't program can't. And I think that's fascinating.
I agree with what you're saying, but I don't entirely agree with the connection. I mean, because ultimately the reason this guy can get a reservation whereas other people can't is because he, and not most people, but a minority of people, him being one of them, can write a script that'll do this. If everybody wrote scripts, then all the scripts would be competing. I mean, it's just moving the bar.
But that's kind of the point. Like, without some kind of regulation of some sort or some other system in place, like, clearly the reservation system at that restaurant should have some kind of CAPTCHA system, some kind of detect if it's a human being filling out the form.
Yeah.
If CAPTCHA that existed,
is the thing where it says, type in this gobbledygook of letters.
Right.
Yeah.
The idea being that a human brain can actually do things a little bit better than a computer in some ways. And so you make the system work better for a human brain, and therefore humans can battle with computers. I mean, that's the thing that it comes down to.
Yeah.
You know, the stock exchange works this way, right? The reason why the stock now moves the speed it does is because of all these computer bots.
I think it's over 50% of transactions. It's something like...
It's millions of times more transactions are done by computer. It's crazy.
Not only done by computer, but are initiated by computer.
By
computer algorithms.
Right, an algorithm.
I think it's like 70 or something.
Yeah,
it's actually a really great radio lab.
Yes, I heard
that
too. And they were talking
about
the location of the machines being really crucial.
Yes.
So like all of a sudden all these data centers went in to wherever the stock exchanges was. I think it was in Virginia. In any case, that was the suggestion of the people that are reading about this system. If you want to get really good hotel reservations at a restaurant, you got to find out where the restaurant's posting their website. Then you got to go and put a computer in that space and make it really, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll get the reservations at that space. You'll own it. Anyway,
so it depends on how many people really, really want reservations at that restaurant.
But as you're correctly, the restaurant, of course, does not want bots to win. The restaurant wants human beings to win.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
So they will probably change the pattern of this and do some more human detection. But keep in mind, we're getting pretty bad at CAPTCHAs because CAPTCHAs have to be really complicated for our brain, for the computers not figure them out, and our brains to figure them out.
Yeah.
So human detection, that's where the AI boundary is right now, is where do you determine if it's a computer or a human? How do you do that determination? And right now I feel like I fail all the time at being a human because I can't read these things. It feels like a judgment call.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, some are so warped that humans can't read them and computers can't read them, but there are some that are done really well. I saw a CAPTCHA actually that people haven't been using, but I think it's brilliant. It shows you a picture, let's say, of an airplane head on. So you can say, oh, it's an airplane. It's facing right at me. And then it shows you several pictures. Which of these pictures is the same? And one is an airplane that's rotated sideways. And one is a car. And one is a dog, you know? Because a computer doesn't know that that is a picture of an airplane which looks like this from the side.
Right.
So, you know,
there
are certain things.
Except that after 2 million responses to these questions, if that data set gets returned back to the systems, then we have the same problem because it will learn.
Right? True.
I mean, we're training the computers to be smarter all the time. So in any case, the engineer that did this reservation project is Diego Monica, and I'll have the article from Ars Technica linked from geekspeak.org. And everything we talk about on Geekspeak is up at geekspeak.org if you want to learn more information.
Those projects are so cool.
Now, Ben, I want to know.
Also, I just want to say the radio lab I was talking about is actually called Speed. That's
Speed.
The name of it. And it's from February 5th. It's a fantastic episode. Of all the radio labs, I think it's probably in my top five.
And we will take the radio lab from that date and also link to it from geekspeak.org.
Absolutely.
Today's show, of course, is August 3rd, 2013. You can find that pretty easily by going to geekspeak.org after the show page is up, which I'll, yeah, oh, 10 seconds. While you're talking about Saturn and its moons.
Saturn? Can I talk about 3D printers instead?
I don't want to hear the story. It's too visual. But okay, go for
it.
Oh, yep,
so
do it fast.
It's so great. Okay, I'll do it fast. So, first of all, so there are actually two stories, so I'll do both of them relatively quickly. Basically, one of them is there was a study by Michigan Technological University, and they discovered that by printing out your own things instead of buying them, like you can print your own shower curtain rings with 3D printers, you can print your own iPhone cases and jewelry organizers. These are some of the examples they give in the article. You can actually recoup the cost of a 3D printer in under a year. So if you buy a 3D printer and then you print a bunch of things instead of buying them using a lot of the 3D models you get online for free, you can actually, you know, it's actually cost effective. And they used conservative numbers as well, including like 20% failure rate on 3D printed objects and things like that.
Cool.
So yeah, that's super cool. And then also there's there are a number of ways of printing things. For a long while, we've only seen printers that they print a layer, and then they print another layer on top and another layer on top. And by changing the shape of all these different layers, you can create these 3D objects really slowly. But we actually have a couple other printers, printer types. There's one called the Material, spelled like Matt Aerial, Material printer. And they use a quick solidifying print material, and that way they can actually print onto the side of objects instead of being restricted to printing from the bottom layer by layer by layer up, right?
Yeah.
But there's also another one called NSTRMNT, which is... instrument, right? God, it's painful to say that, but basically they're at the Southern California Institute of Architecture. They created a 3D printing process called suspended disposition. Basically what happens is instead of printing this object in air like you normally would, they're printing inside of a gel that has a similar viscosity as the stuff that they're squirting out of the little printing gun, and that allows them to attach things to any side.
Okay,
does
so you get a vat of this jelly stuff, and you get a robot arm that's moving around inside there, and you start squirting, and wherever it squirts its thing that will become the solid, it stays where it is because it's kind of in this gel.
Yeah, it basically defies gravity by having the same viscosity, the same floatiness, if you will, as the thing around it, the gel around it. So that's pretty compelling. It means that you can create all kinds of interesting shapes that you just can't create using the bottom-up technique.
Yeah.
Like if you wanted to make a three-dimensional S block letter, you couldn't do that using the 3D-up technique because the top of the S kind of hooks around and then goes down, and you wouldn't be able to print the bottom of the hook of the S. Because there would be nothing to support it. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And so the way you would get around that with a traditional thing is you would actually print a support, like a little beam or something, to support that
and
layer.
And then you cut it out later with a Xacto blade.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You take a Xacto blade or something. So anyway, those are some interesting stories about 3D printing that I'm pretty excited about.
Okay, yeah. Okay, you're right. Those were cool.
Yeah,
sorry.
They were pretty cool. I can talk about Saturn, but do you want to cover one?
Yeah, let me talk about something. So you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. And we are talking about, we're talking about lots of things today. We're talking about geek news. And in about 15 minutes, I'll invite you to take the call. We do need to talk about Robert Pauly's awesome show. In the mid-1960s, Indonesian death squads killed as many as 2 million people accused of being communists. The killers were hailed as patriots. And when filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer asked some former death squad leaders to reenact the murders as stars in their own movie, they happily obliged. KOSP's Robert Pauly talks to Oppenheimer about the acclaimed new documentary, The Act of Killing, which is a rare look at genocide through the perpetrator's own eyes. And that chilling episode of Seventh Avenue Projects tomorrow at noon, on Sunday at noon, on KOSP. You are listening to KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. On Geek Speak, we sometimes do stories that you have to see to really understand. We call those geek bits.
Hey, Lyle, I got one of them.
Go for it.
And it is, Enceladus. Do you know what Enceladus is?
I don't even know what that word is.
It's the name of one of Saturn's many, many moons. I think it has 20-something moons, 26 moons or something.
It's a busy little planet.
Yeah, definitely.
Big planet.
We've got one moon. But anyway, and it's got the rings, too. I kind of want to visit, but unfortunately, it's a bit too far away for me to visit, and spacesuits can be dangerous. But Cassini is a satellite which we launched and we sent over to Saturn. It's been buzzing around Saturn and taking all kinds of incredible shots, and that's my geek bit, actually. There's a picture of Enceladus, and when you first look at it... Here, I'll just turn my computer around so you can see it. When you first look at it, it looks like
our moon. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like a crescent moon. It's just a normal picture of a crescent moon that is not our moon and is a billion miles away. So, you know.
That's cool.
I think it's awesome. Right. Yeah. I actually also have another story... speaking of Enceladus, actually.
Yeah,
of all things, I have another story about Enceladus. And Enceladus is, I'm sorry, 62 moons, actually, Saturn has. So it's a really busy planet. It's got these giant plumes of water vapor and ice that blast out into space from its surface.
Yeah.
And these are things that you can't really see from far away. But Cassini, the spacecraft, since it's a lot closer, can see these things. Enceladus is only 310 miles in diameter, so it's not very big. It's a very small moon. So we would expect a moon like this to be frozen completely solid because it's so far away from the sun and it's made largely of water and water vapor and ice and things. But it's got these plumes, these giant plumes. And so we were trying to figure out why. So part of the answer, at least, is gravitational variations during the moon's orbit. So the moon has a 1.37-day orbit around Saturn. So it's whizzing around really, really fast, which means it's very close to Saturn. So here on Earth, we don't experience this, but they actually exist. They're very, very small. They're called tidal forces. So that means that because your feet are closer to the center of the Earth than your head is,
yes,
your feet actually experience a very, very slightly greater gravitational pull than your head.
Yes.
So with the Earth, since we're pretty far away from the center, we don't really feel that. Now, if you were falling into a black hole, before you pass the event horizon, that's the point beyond which light cannot even escape, right? And you hear about that when you read about black holes. It turns out that if you were falling into a black hole, you would die far before you reach the event horizon because of this process called spaghettification. And basically, it's as you get closer and closer.
You don't have to say anything else. Spaghettification. Everyone knows what that is.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, if you want a really great...
It has to do with the difference of gravitational pull from your feet to your head.
Exactly.
If you're going feet first. Right.
So black holes are so much more massive than the Earth that as you fall into a black hole, the difference in gravity from your feet to your head becomes so great that you actually would start bifurcating, I think is the word. If you want to hear more about it, Neil deGrasse Tyson, renowned astrophysicist, Hayden's planetarium, he has a really great explanation on YouTube. It's really amusing to hear him talk about it. In any case, Saturn's moon Enceladus is close enough to Saturn that actually it feels a little bit of tidal forces. So one side of the moon feels more gravity from Saturn than the other side. So as the moon...
Where?
Enceladus. So one side of Enceladus is closer,
denser?
Slightly closer Saturn.
And it's orbital locked. Right.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if it's... I don't think it's tidally locked, but it might be. I'm not sure about that. But in any case, as it rotates and
it must not be. Okay.
Yeah. So as it moves around Saturn, as it orbits and as it spins on its own axis, different parts of it are closer to Saturn and different parts of it are far further away, which means that instead of being a perfect sphere, it actually gets churned a little bit. And because of that churning...
What Ben's doing with his hands is like churning. It's
yeah.
Really nice.
Like
it's
imagine...
Squishiness. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, in any case. It pretty much gets churned up.
Record a video.
Oh,
go ahead,
no.
Do the churning again. Go on, do it.
Okay, so
churn.
For context...
quickly churn.
Churning, okay.
Yes, nice.
Lyle has Google Glasses on his face.
Google Glass.
Google Glass. Sorry, yeah. I got to get it right.
No, let's not go into that, please. Anyway, the orbit of the planet is being... squished and flexed.
So because it's doing this churning, that churning actually gets turned into heat. And that heat creates melting, kind of, you know? And so the ice is not all ice. There's a lot of ice on Enceladus, but it's not all ice. Presumably, somewhere in the middle, there's water. And as the ice crust gets churned around, little cracks form and water spurts out.
Yeah.
And that's what these plumes are. And we didn't know that before. Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
I heard a little discussion about this, like that Saturn's ring is actually, you know, crystallized stuff. So it could be that it's these moons being manipulated and squished around to deal with this. And by the way, gravity is famously, but not totally accurately, an inverse square power. Well, magnetism is different than that. So magnetism operates at a different ratio. And this hints that we're
it's not inverse square?
It's a different ratio.
Really? I didn't know that.
And I can't recall what it is. But this is part of this idea of the inverse square law of gravity, which is this kind of strange effect where it's long distances away, it can still have, you know, effect based on the mass. That's some of the hints that we see to us having more than three dimensions of space. That's what part of that idea is. But I won't get into the quantum
theory. With the magnetism thing?
With both of them, these forces that exist in a certain way, you could assume that the reason why they affect, you know what, going in more detail than just saying that leads us astray.
But so. A quick explanation of inverse square basically means if I am 10 feet away from you, okay, I'm going to have let's say there's a certain amount of gravitational attraction between two bodies at 10 feet away. If you get half the distance, the gravity is not going to be twice as strong. It's going to be four times as strong. Right. And that means that the closer you are, the more, way, way more massively amount of gravity you feel.
Right. Okay,
and that's
so
why
in
you
a magnet,
end up with tidal forces.
And a magnet, it disappears much faster, and it's actually inverse of a cube of the distance.
And
so
that's why
it's faster. It doesn't affect things as far a distance.
Incidentally, those teeny little magnets, the really, really small neodymium magnets that they say in huge letters, do not swallow. It's because what can actually happen is if you swallow two of these, let's say separately, then one of them will be maybe further along in your small intestines than the other, and if they happen to pinch any kind of tissue between them because of the inverse cube, as they get closer, they get way, way stronger, which means that they can actually cause ruptures inside of your body.
Inside your intestinal tract.
Yeah, it's bad
so if
news,
you're going to swallow one, just swallow one, and then wait a week, and then
God,
you're okay.
No,
do not. That's why we say, you know, don't let
it's
little kids
really
play
dangerous,
with it. It's very dangerous. How does an intestine actually push things along?
Peristalsis.
Peristalsis?
Peristalsis.
Oh,
yeah.
Go on. Do you have a story about peristalsis by chance?
Oh, that actually connects back to that story you didn't want me to cover about, you know, the 3D printers. Just basically that when it pushes out the material, it uses a pump that uses peristalsis.
Okay, so peristalsis.
Is
if you take a tube of liquid, for example, and you squeeze it with your hand, and then
in one place,
and then to one direction, you squeeze it again. Of course, the liquid has to push out of its way.
Wait, I got a really good way of explaining
metaphor.
This.
Yeah, please.
A honey straw. If you have the little straws of honey,
a honey straw.
You've never heard of a honey straw?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, the little straws of honey.
Or a tube of toothpaste
kind of
works this way, too, I would guess.
Yeah, a tube of toothpaste, if you imagine the tube is much longer. And so you squeeze the liquid out from one end to the other. So imagine that's happening with a bunch of little muscles. That's what happens with your with
your
body.
One squeezes, then the next squeezes. And once the second one is squeezed, the first one can open again, letting more stuff come in. And that's what's actually happening.
Yeah, and you get this kind of a rippling effect.
But when you have two magnets that actually, because the intestines curl around, they'll connect to each other and they can actually rip through the intestinal wall. It's really bad.
So, yeah, real bad.
Really cool magnets, but not so good for eating.
Yeah, there's
a lot of things are like that.
That's true. Like Google Glass. Don't eat Google
Glass.
Oh, you said
it's really good? Ben says it's really good.
I don't know. Presumably, you're wearing it all the time.
Hey, you know, let's talk about Black Hat.
Yeah, let's change the subject.
What's Black Hat, Ben?
Black Hat? If you imagine you have a cap on and it's black. Okay, so Black Hat, gray hat, and White Hat. That's right? Black Hat is basically people who are hacking, but they're maybe doing for not the best purposes, right? And White Hats are people who are hacking, but for good purposes. So imagine if you run a company and you need someone to try and hack into your systems to try and find the vulnerabilities before the bad guys do, the hacker that you would hire is a White Hat hacker. He's a hacker who's trying to find all the vulnerabilities, but not trying to take advantage of them, trying to find them them so that way they can be patched before other people do.
Right. Now, there's
also... Gray hats are like in between,
yeah.
You know?
No, there's also a conference in Las Vegas, which is actually what I was looking for, but thanks for the explanation. That was perfect.
Sure.
Black Hat is a hacking convention that occurs every year. It just happened. And because of that, what happens is all these really security-aware geeks get together and present their papers about vulnerabilities they've discovered. And so it's a really big conference. In fact, a couple of our geeks have gone to before. I think Lindsay Lonnie's gone, Alex Slius goes, and sometimes we get reports from them. But after that happens, you see all these great news stories that are summaries of an investigation and release, like a paper release. It's kind of like an... and like 2 weeks ago, we talked about how the organizers of Black Hat requested that the federal government not participate this year because they didn't like what they were doing. Now, of course, the federal government could go anyway as individuals, but yeah, interesting. So... The title I'm reading on this one is from the Technology Review. It's all over the place, but Chinese hacking team caught taking over decoy water plant. So this...
What?
Yeah. This is about a group that was detected because...
Okay, well...
First off, Willett is one of the researchers, and he or she, I'm not really sure, created a computer on the net that looked like a water treatment computer. A computer that was controlling a water treatment center.
Also, just to say, electrical utilities, water utilities, all these things, they're not just, you know, simple manual things like they used to be. They're controlled by computers, and those computers have to talk to each other, and they're on the internet.
Yes.
And a lot of them are not even protected.
No security. Yeah,
because who would want to take over a power plant?
Right.
Oh, I don't know.
So, any case, this group called APT1, this hacking group that looks like it's originating in China, went ahead and exploited this computer that looked like a water treatment center. Now, keep in mind, the term for this in computer terminology is called a honeypot. You basically make a computer that you make a system that looks like a target system, and it looks all attractive and yummy, like Pooh Bear would want a honeypot, right? And then the people come and they get stuck in it, and their hands are stuck in the honey because as they investigate it, the investigators are actually looking more at the hackers that are trying to get in, or crackers that are trying to get in. So it becomes a tool to investigate the group. And so, yeah, it's clear. The thing that was interesting is that there's been a lot of debate and talk about whether there are organizations that are attempting to get access to these water systems, power stations, and things of that nature, or whether it's just happening kind of accidentally because you make a bot and you release it in the wild and it goes. This one was being... The honeypot was being looked at by the investigators that did this project, and they were looking at it at the time and knew that a human being was involved in the process because it got some complicated steps. They could detect that, yes, they were actively trying to take over this computer. So there are active groups trying to take over water district and power stations and that kind of sort. And it's not that hard to do, unfortunately. So that's a little disconcerting. You kind of want valves and levers to happen and have some guy named Frank and some woman named Julie that take care of the place 24/7 and know exactly what valves are on, rather than some computer system that can get hacked remotely from another country.
But of course, you wouldn't need just Frank and Julie. You'd need Frank and Julie and 300 other specialists who would make more mistakes than computers.
See, that's the problem, I guess, right?
Unless the computers are unprotected and they get taken over. Because, I mean, imagine, you know, that would be a fantastic way for some black hat hacker to really mess things up, take over the electrical or the water system for a city.
Right.
I mean, it's not...
It sounds
actually,
like a Batman episode.
It's unfortunately not as hard as it feels like it should be. It's like...
A great summary.
This is
unfortunately not as hard as it feels like it should be. You're awesome,
I guess that
Ben.
Was... Yeah.
No, it's great. I mean, it's exactly the thing. As much as we talk about this, as much detail we get into it,
and you
how
can
it
do
works.
It from anywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
So the other... And I'll just mention quickly, the other conference stuff that occurred during... The other one I found was really interesting is the cell phones hackable. So the same type of investigation emerged that there's a few million cell phones out there. I'll get the exact number in a second. That the SIM card itself has a security flaw. It uses DES, which is not the best algorithm for encryption. In fact, we use triple DES now. You just do it multiple times and it gets better and stronger. And basically, this one was a German cryptographer, Carsten Noe, figured out that there's flaws in hundreds of millions of phones that allows him to, or anybody that knows the knowledge that he now shared, to send a text message to a cell phone. The text message is never displayed. Then get the data necessary to send a signed application to the same phone, and that application will be automatically installed and running.
Oh, only hundreds of millions?
Only a few
That's
hundred
all?
Million, yeah.
What?
Yeah, it's not that many.
Oh.
That's enough, isn't it? Isn't the population of the United States enough to concern? So the problem with this kind of stuff is he, of course, went ahead and sent this detail to the cell phone companies. But we're talking about cell phones that maybe don't even have update capabilities, right? They're just the older phones. And even if they did, do the cell company care that much that this can occur? Because what's the real problem, right? A person gets their identity stolen. Why does the cell phone company necessarily care? And that's the thing that's so concerning about this, is that because we have proprietary software that we do not control, that is in our personal space, that then has a vulnerability that somebody takes advantage of, now without anybody taking care of you and without you being able to investigate it yourself, you are in the situation where your privacy is at risk. And that's happening all the time. Now for more cheery news, Ben.
I mean, I was going to talk about camping and circadian rhythms, but I feel obliged now to mention my bit of security. Not even security theater, unfortunately. It's all real. Bummer, huh? So on Monday, this last Monday, a major Russian newspaper reported that Moscow's metro system is planning to track mobile phones. Now, tracking mobile phones in Russia is illegal, but tracking the SIM cards inside of mobile phones is not, because technically, legally, the SIM cards are the property of the cell phone companies. How how awful is that?
That's horrible.
Yeah. So now we're not tracking your phone.
All we need is a white hat hacker that will now take this exploit and make those chips not accessible. Okay,
yeah,
so
unfortunately they are. And the reason that they God, it's just funny to me that they're even trying to justify this. It seems so but they're like, no, guys, really. We're just trying to help people recover their stolen phones. That's all we're trying to do.
And why wouldn't you? Why do you hate people?
Yeah, so but I mean pretty much everyone is seeing right through this, and they're like, yeah, that's sketchy. So anyway, that's something that's going on.
We're going to take calls about questions that we've dealt with already today. So if we've covered something today on the episode and you want to know more information about it, you want us to, what's that great word that you mean?
To elaborate?
Something like that.
Elucidate, elaborate?
Yeah, exactly. No. That one. I know you're looking at
it. Continue.
You can call us up and you can even give us that word if you'd like. The phone number is 800-655-5877. Again, nice and slow, 1-800-655-5877. We got really a lot more cool stories to cover as well, so do stick with us. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. And he hasn't been here a while. Where you been, Ben?
I have been, well, partially camping. Also, a family member had a wedding. And, but a lot of camping. Camping-ish things. But I found a story, actually, about camping. And it is talking about your circadian rhythm. So your circadian rhythm is your body wants to go to sleep at a certain time. Your body wants to wake up at a certain time, right? That's your circadian rhythm. Now, your natural circadian rhythm, you go to sleep maybe an hour or so after the sun sets. This, of course, depends on where you are in the world. And then you wake up either just before or just after the sun rises. It turns, and of course, now, especially here in Silicon Valley, in the Silicon Valley area, we have a lot of computer people. And programmers and also general computer users tend to stay up very late and then you go to bed around midnight or something.
That's not late.
Yeah.
2 a.m., buddy.
After midnight. Okay, right. Fine. And you wake up around 8 a.m., 7 a.m.?
I have kids, 6:30, 7.
You get 4 hours of sleep every night?
Sometimes I get more.
How do you? Wow. Okay, well.
Coffee, baby.
Coffee. So you have 5/6 of the amount of time. Yeah, you sleep for 1/6 of the
of what I should.
24 hours. Cycle.
Unless I'm camping.
Unless you're camping. Well, it turns out, yeah. If you take pretty much anyone, this is generally true. If you take pretty much anybody, even if it's your crazy programming friend who stays up until 4 a.m. and, you know, goes to sleep and wake up at 10, goes into work late, is really groggy in the morning, as many of us are. If you take them and you take them camping, and you don't allow them to bring flashlights or mobile devices or electronic devices, within a week, their circadian rhythm will pretty much be back to what it should be, which it should naturally be.
Yeah. I think that's kind of funny because, of course, the circadian rhythm is the naturally defined rhythm of the body without artificial lighting.
Exactly.
So if you take a human being that's healthy, or relatively healthy without some kind of strange disease, mm-hmm. and you put them in a situation where they don't have artificial lighting, they do what humans do.
Yeah, they do what humans normally do.
Is that important?
I just found it interesting to see a study about this, right? And I think the mechanism behind it is really interesting. A lot of times if you're going, like if you're flying across the world, for example, you can take these melatonin pills, for example. You can take other pills which will put you to sleep on the airplane, but melatonin pills, they don't put you to sleep so much as they allow your body to more easily fall asleep. And the reason this happens is that melatonin is naturally produced whenever it's dark, right? So when it becomes dark somewhere around, let's say, 7, 8, 9 p.m., your body will start producing a lot of melatonin unless you're inside with all the artificial light. That'll keep you up. That'll keep your melatonin mm-hmm. from being produced. Once you go to bed, the sun comes up, but you still have a bunch of melatonin in you. You wake up, you feel groggy, you feel unrested, and there's actually a connection there, right? So
cool.
having a natural circadian rhythm actually is quite nice. I actually have one right now. I've been going to bed around 8:30 or 9 and waking up.
So this is the
5:30.
Thing that messes me up when I actually travel too, mm-hmm. when I go to Europe or something.
Oh yeah,
is this
Europe,
the same thing?
On a jet all the time, right?
Well, but also I then have time shifts that are pretty strict, right?
So if you have a huge time, if you go to like Paris or something for work, what you could do is just arrive in Paris, go camping for a week, and you'll be fine, right?
I can go camping here. All right. Thank you, Ben, for that great story about circadian rhythms. Now, before the show, we were talking about Wi-Fi and AT&T and such, and you had a pretty interesting story that I wanted you to cover. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology, but only about the stuff we've talked about today on the show. Ben, elaborate.
Starbucks. So if you go to Starbucks and you connect to their free Wi-Fi, you'll be connecting to AT&T free Wi-Fi or something like that. Google is actually replacing that. And
this is very good news for me.
This is very good news
I'll explain
you.
In a second.
Okay, good. And actually, the story says that Google was not meeting with Starbucks to replace their Wi-Fi, but I guess they had a really good salesperson because now they're actually replacing, I think, all 7,000 Starbucks locations in the United States, and it'll be 10 times faster than the current AT&T provided service.
Interesting.
AT&T says,
wait
a second.
Is it just the United States?
According to this article. This is starting in August. This is right about now. It'll be rolling out.
Oh, so good.
And AT&T's official response, paraphrased by me, is like, wait a second. No, we'll give you more speed. Wait a
wait,
second.
What happened? Wait,
come
what?
Back. Come back. So,
So, okay.
Why is this so good for you?
It's a really stupid reason.
You Google lover.
Because I've got glass on my face. I'm now a Google lover. So, because I've got this Android device strapped in my head all the time, the way that you sign it, there's different ways of signing into
I'm
Wi-Fi
glad it's
access
not
points.
Actually strapped on your head. I'm glad it's just, you know.
If I went skydiving, it would be. I would use a rubber band.
Okay.
But I got kids. I don't think I'm going to go skydiving. So, the issue with Wi-Fi access points, we all know that you can get connected to a free access point. You can also get one that has WAP or WEP, then you have to put a username and password, and those are ones that are called locked, you know, the little lock symbol.
Yeah.
And you have to know the codes for those secondary ones. But the primary ones, the ones that are normally at coffee shops and these public spaces, are actually there's no authentication process necessary to actually connect to it. But then as soon as you connect, the first thing you get is like a web page, and the web page says, do you agree to these rules and regulations?
Yeah, I go to Facebook.com, and it doesn't go to Facebook.com.
Right.
It redirects me.
Right. And you get a security warning sometimes. And
which,
it's kind of
incidentally, is horrible if you open up, say, Google Chrome and it auto-restores 100 windows, which all get redirected.
Oh, yeah. It's lovely. I love that. I know exactly what you're talking about. So, and nobody else does. That's okay.
It's so bad.
So when you're using something that doesn't have a typewriter on it and you want to connect to one of these ones that says put in your username and password on a web page, you can't. So Google Glass cannot connect to these ones that like require you to do other things.
Because do you have to say your password to do it?
No, you don't say a password. It's not like the SNL episode. No, what happens is you can't fill out a web form with it. You can't do that. So you can click on things on a web page, but lots of times these things are like agree to these terms. You can agree to the terms. That kind of works, but that only is for a certain session. Anyway, it's very difficult to use something like that through Google Glass. It's not an easy process. Mm. So you do it instead is you tether it to one of your devices, and your devices that has a typewriter does it, and it's just kind of a mess. But since Google is controlling me anyway,
typewriter.
I'm sorry. Typewriter?
Yeah, you keep saying it has a typewriter attached.
Yeah, whenever I say keyboard, it sounds like we're playing music.
This heavy 60-pound tethered, because I have a typewriter. They're heavy.
Do you take it camping?
No, I don't. Actually, no. Yeah, I have. It's wonderful. Anyway.
So in any case, because Google will be providing the Wi-Fi in these spaces that they're all over the place, they'll probably fix this problem because, of course, they already own me. I mean, sorry. They already own the connection I have to Google Glass to their services, yeah. Right? Any case, for the rest of the human race, can you tell us, you got a lot of other stories.
I have a question. Do you have to connect to Wi-Fi to have internet, or does it go through the cell towers too?
You can tether to your phone. So I actually have my iPhone, which doesn't talk nicely to Google Glass, tethered. Every time I'm on a Geek Speak lately, I've seen we talk a lot about Glass. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. I've been building applications with it, though. You tried my application. That was kind of fun.
Cool. You're like one in 5,000 people who have
something like that. Yeah, it's kind of fun.
Minus developers and things.
In 6 years, everybody knows what I'm talking about. I don't know actually when it's going to come out, and I'm assuming... by the way, I put Google Glass on about 700 people now. I've put them on their face and tried it out. And I say that because I've gone to a couple conferences with 200, 300 people, and everybody there tried it, and then I've gone to a few other meetups, and then everybody I know. So probably I've put it on about 600 people and gotten their opinion. Most people are like, oh, cool, and smile. Does that mean anything to you? Is that... I mean, what do you think? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Whatever.
Go camping.
I have a question for you, actually. Being someone who wears glass while it's novel, it's kind of like someone who had an iPhone when it was novel.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, you have an iPhone. Oh my God, you have an iPad. Oh my God, you have a Google Glass. Has that detracted from the conversations that you have with people? Are you kind of tired of always having to talk about glass, whereas it can't really as easily talk about
the people around me that I know?
Yeah,
I see enough such that we've already had that conversation. We don't do it again. And the people that I do not know, like strangers at a coffee shop or something, come up to me and talk to me. I like to talk to people, right?
Yeah.
So I've met a lot of people I wouldn't normally meet and had really interesting conversations with people from all over the place because I have this thing on my face.
But
it's
kind
of like a signer on my sign that says, hello, come talk to me.
Yeah.
At the conference, a lot of it was about that. But then, you know, after you break the ice with what this thing is and, you know, it's a 4-minute conversation, then you know the person. You say, well, what do you do? What are you interested in?
And it's like having a really cute puppy.
It's like having a cute puppy.
Oh, my God.
It's having a cute digital puppy strapped to my face. That's exactly what Google Glass
is. It does not look like a cute puppy. I'm sorry. You kind of look like a cyborg.
Okay.
And you look a little crazy when you look up in the corner of your vision at the glass and you like tap it and everything.
Yeah.
It's not a criticism, just an observation.
You know, I'm thinking a lot about these behaviors that humans have now in this era. It used to be that if you saw someone walking alone by themselves and then they stopped and they looked at their hand for a few minutes and played with their hand for a few minutes in the palm of their hand and then moved on, you'd think, this person might have a problem. But now everybody does that all the time, right? They're looking at Facebook, of course. We know that they're actually engaged in some device. But from an actual physical manifestation of who a human being is on the planet, if you just look at what they're doing, it's crazy.
I still have not gotten used to the people in grocery stores with Bluetooth headsets. Talking to themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still...
I was walking in New York with my cousin, and we're walking along, and someone's behind us, quote, having a conversation. He had a device on. He could have been having a conversation. But the way he was having the conversation was like the other person must have just been going, because he was really just rambling about the world around him. And I'm thinking, this is just an excuse for him to talk to himself. I know it. And so as I was listening to the conversation, he started getting a little crass and inappropriate. And I took my cousin. We went to a Starbucks to get some Wi-Fi. But but I knew the guy was not really talking to anybody. But I had to think about it for a while to figure it out.
That's interesting.
Got another story. We're close to the end of the show.
I don't know. I could talk about another one if you want.
Yeah, please take it. You got like 20 stories, so go for it.
Oh, I got to remember what this one is. Okay. So pinch to zoom. I don't know. Patent issues are just, they're interesting to cover briefly. Apple and Samsung, I believe it is, have been engaged in a legal dispute for a little while. Apple claims that Samsung is using pinch to zoom, which is where you use two fingers to zoom in and out of a map app or a photo app or something
like
that.
Right, the interface gesture of using two fingers to engage with size.
It's on pretty much every mobile device imaginable now. And Apple has a patent on it. And I'm putting patents in air quotes because...
They claim to have a patent on it.
They claim to, but it is not... It's been basically ruled not valid because it either could have been it was either already created because other people had patented different parts of it that combined make up that functionality, or it is unpatentable. And I'm not actually sure which one the injunction says because it doesn't say in the article I found. So that's an interesting thing.
Cool.
You want another one?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Rapid fire ones?
Yeah,
okay.
Go for it, man.
So an iPhone was hacked using a malicious charger. So someone created, basically it just looks like an iPhone charger, except it is malicious. It actually pulls data off, it pulls contacts off. So don't plug in your iPhone to weird-looking plugs places. People.
Now, these weird plugs don't look like weird plugs. I mean, you could put the same circuitry in a totally iPhone-looking plug.
That's true.
So, and then you could sell them for cheap.
So if you see an iPhone plug just sitting in a coffee shop with nobody around it, maybe you don't want to plug your phone into that.
Maybe not.
Yeah. It's like, don't eat that weird scone that's been sitting on the table for 2 hours. Like, just don't do it. Like,
oh, but it's so delicious.
Yeah. Also, let me see. There was a near disaster with a spacesuit where, it's really bad. The refrigeration part of the spacesuit, because you need refrigeration in a spacesuit. Otherwise, you overheat in like 30 seconds or a minute or something. Started pumping water into the helmet. And this is
no,
really,
no, no. Were they in space?
They were in space.
Oh, no.
On a spacewalk.
What'd you
this
do?
This is really bad because... Because first of all, they're in space in a helmet. You can't reach your face. You can't you can't just take off your helmet to drain the helmet, right? So it wasn't pumping that much water, but it was starting to pump water. And you don't want to choke on water either.
No, you
zero
don't.
G. It's bad.
This is GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. He's used with permission. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me was Ben Jaffe. Answering the phones today was Rick. And we'll be back next week, same time, same channel. And, of course, everything we talked about on GeekSpeak today, you can learn more about at geekspeak.org. Thank you so much for participating by listening. And also, during the week, if you have questions or suggestions or news stories, please follow us on Twitter and Facebook and send us data, and we'll include it in the show. Thank you so much. We'll be here again next week.
See you guys.